Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 128 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. Welcome to the final episode of season 6. I am still coming to you from Malaga in Spain. They have not kicked us out of the country. Hopefully they will not, though it does seem like they will be sending us a speeding ticket in the mail. I just returned yesterday from a 4-day trip to Vienna in Austria for a film festival. I guess that is one of the cool things now about this European experiment we're doing. When a last-minute opportunity to travel to somewhere within the EU pops up, you can do it fairly inexpensively, especially if you are willing to sleep in a hostel dorm, as I did for 4 nights, despite the fact that everyone I talked to said, "Oh wow, I can't do that anymore." And I replied with, "Oh well, I'm pretty good with noise. I come from a big family, so I'll be fine." And then I experienced 4 restless nights with very little sleep. My abilities to deal with noise were tested immediately from night 1, when the person in the bunk above me was snoring so loudly that it sounded like he was gasping for air and whistling directly into my ear. And every night, more and more people in the room joined in on the snoring. And by the 4th night, there was loud snoring coming from all corners. And one of the people would periodically have nightmares, which included him making loud, growling monster noises and then screaming for help, all while in his sleep. One of the other people in the room, who also was never getting sleep at night, I could tell because of the light from his cell phone and his constant sighs, got up at 2 a.m, got dressed, packed all of his stuff, took his blankets, and got the hell out. But anyway, it was a good trip, and I may be joining the team of no longer staying in hostels, or at least no more than 1 or 2 nights at a time. But that's enough about me. Let's get to this, the final episode of the season. As for season 7, I'm not sure if or when that is coming. It will probably be a pretty large break. While we are getting adjusted to life here in Spain, I have to figure out if to bring the show back, how to bring the show back, how to produce it from Spain, if it will evolve. In the meantime, you can at least follow along on the Go Get Outside podcast YouTube page. I will continue to upload videos there, including some videos about expat life in Spain. So if you want to see what that's like, go join that YouTube page. And since this is the end of the season and an atypical episode, I'll do all of the stuff I usually say for the end right now. So if you want to get in touch with us here at the show, you can email us, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send a text or leave a voicemail at +1 818-925-0106. And please go to your podcast purveyor of choice, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Most importantly, share it with someone who you think will enjoy it. And if you look down in the show notes for this episode, or go to our website, gogetoutside.com, and look for this, episode 128, you can find some photos from Spain thus far, but then also links to all of the previous episodes that are referenced in this episode. This is a Go Gumbo episode, and if you are a previous listener, you may be familiar with this format. What I do is I take stories from previous episodes, cut them down, add music, sound effects, try to build an atmosphere, and hopefully make the stories even more entertaining. So in this episode, the 3rd of the Go Gumbo series, I'm bringing you 5 stories from season 6. They will be bookended by stories from Jane Fontana and Mark Fitzsimmons, but will also include stories from Bill Sharpstein, Pamela Zulalian, and Jesse St. Louis. So I'm going to shut up. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining in season 1 or season 6 or whenever you came along. Hopefully you're enjoying the show. I'm going to do my best to bring it back. But now let's go listen to 5 tales. We'll start with a dreadful discovery while hiking in the Angeles Forest. Follow that up with the unexpected dangers one may encounter while jogging in Alaska. And then a story about a lack of preparedness in a wildfire recovery area. Followed up by a story of self-discovery and finding purpose on a waterfall. And then we'll close it out with a joyful tale of a late-night rescue of Boy Scouts. We'll be right back.
I was with Johanna Turner, and we had gone on a really early morning hike with her dog. We did this little hike that's trailless. There were so many snags that the dog was getting held up by the leash situation, so we decided we'd find another hike to do. But while we were turning around, there was a puddle of blood, and Johanna was wondering if it could be like a cougar kill, and she got really excited. But then we saw more evidence of it as we were returning. We also found a spot where there was unusual footprints, and to me it looked like there was somebody having a fist fight, stepping up and stepping back and stepping up and stepping back. I said, well, maybe somebody hit somebody with a bottle and they just were dragging them back to rescue them after they'd done that, and it was just tempers flared or something. So Johanna and I just were on our way out, and some Department of Public Works came and told us that it wasn't really a safe place to park where we had parked because there's a lot of break-ins and stuff. And I said, well, speaking of safety, I pointed out the blood to the guy. Then Johanna and I went on another hike somewhere else. When we returned, Johanna left, and she called me right away on her way home and said, there are so many law enforcement people over where we were hiking. It's crazy. I don't know what's happening. So I decided to call the sheriff and tell them what I saw. 2 weeks later, they called me and said that they'd like to talk to me about it. They asked me to come to the scene, and I went over there and was walking around showing them some of the spots. And that's when I realized that what I thought were the fistfight footprints were actually somebody tamping down a grave, and that the person was underneath there, which was pretty chilling. Later, they asked me to testify at the trial of the murderer. They caught the murderer. They had the perpetrator in custody for credit card fraud with the credit cards of the deceased, but they didn't have any other notion. But I did get to talk to, like, the cadaver dog lady and a few other people to find out more about how they had progressed to find out who he was and how they caught him and actually why they killed the victim. He was a really young guy, 23, and he had met some guy on Craigslist and got a room from that situation. And right after he moved in, he overheard a conversation about these guys embezzling money from the Boy Scouts, and they saw that he heard them, and they killed him for that reason. The guy was kind of a terrifying guy, but it was a good experience. The family, after I testified, came and gave me hugs and was really, really thankful. The other law enforcement officials were also really thankful. They said to me that if we had not found that evidence, that they never would have known. It would have just been a missing person forever.
I've run ever since I was in my early 20s. Most of the roads in Bethel were gravel, which is fine for running. And during the winter, they're covered by this really hard-packed snow. It becomes crystalline. There would be snowmobile trails that would go off from Bethel to some of the closer villages. So I discovered these snowmobile trails were wonderful for running because it was hard-packed snow. It was like running over beach sand that was really hard-packed. And the other element about tundra is that there are a bazillion ponds. And of course, they're all frozen over during the winter. And on the snowmobile trails, the snowmobiles would go over the ice and it would get all roughed up. So you could run across this ice without slipping. was a gorgeous day. It was maybe 15 degrees, and I decided to go for a run in the afternoon. I get out of the trailer, and I run down the road about half mile, and I come to where the snowmobile trail attached to the road. Just as I got to that intersection, I saw this musher hitching up his sled dog team, and he had seven dogs hitched up two by two by two, and then the lead dog, he's on a long lead in front. So I just kind of waved to him, and I started down the trail, and I just thought, well, I just need to listen for them coming up because you don't want to get run over by those guys. So, I don't know, maybe I was running 15, 20 minutes and I heard them coming up behind me. So I pull off the trail about 5 feet. Now, the thing about sled dogs is they are so easily spooked. They're like thoroughbred horses. I step off the trail thinking 5 feet's enough and I expect him to just blast by. The lead dog veered off the trail, runs behind me while the other six dogs stay on the trail. They're all attached by a line. And I see this yellow rope whipping at my knees. I don't know how I did it, but I had the reaction time like a cat to just jump up. So the rope just managed to right under my feet. The musher stops. He has this big hook that he puts into the snow, an anchor, and he's gathering up the dogs and trying to get them rearranged on the trail. Well, because it's 15 degrees, I'm not going to stand there waiting for him to get this done. You know, I said, I'm going to take off. I ran down the trail. A few minutes later, they're coming back down the trail. And this time I go 10 feet off. I thought, no problem, it's 10 feet. This time, the lead dog veers off the trail, jumps up, and bites me in the stomach. Teeth right through my clothes and leaves a big cut in my stomach. And I'm just shocked. A second later, I look down, and all seven dogs are bunched up right in front of me with these zombie eyes. And I'm going, oh my gosh, I am in such trouble. The musher is yelling at them, and they're just totally ignoring him. So I take one step backwards. They all took one step forward with these glazed eyes. And I take another step back, and they all took a step forward. And that second step, I noticed how the ground was starting to slope behind me, downward. And I realized there must be a pond behind me. I got ice right behind me. And I think, if I take another step onto that ice, I'm bound to slip. But I figured, I got to do something. I took another step, slipped on my back, and all seven dogs descended on me. They went behind my head, so I couldn't see them, but they were lunging at my neck, literally going for the jugular. I'm swinging my fists back behind my head just blindly, and I remember hitting a couple snouts and thinking, well, maybe that's going to discourage them. And the lead dog sneaked around, grabbed a hold of my calf, and just ripped a hole in my calf. So I took my right foot and kicked him in the head. And finally, the musher realized that calling out these dogs was going to do no good. And he grabbed a hold of the lead dog. And the minute he did that, the others just totally pacified. I'm scrambled backwards on the ice, and I look over, and there's like blood on the ice. And I go, oh my God, that must be me. And he took the lead dog, and he's smashing its head on the ice and swearing and cussing. This is just like a surreal moment for me. The musher started talking to me like it was my fault. But fortunately, he said, well, you know, I'll cover your medical bills. And I just ran back home. So I went to a clinic and I got a long lecture on rabies and what to look, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I got a tetanus shot and I became the talk of the town. I actually had people asking me to roll up my pant legs so they could see the dog bite.
It was one of those days where I was in the process of redoing the wood-burning stove, and I had wood supplies, I had concrete, I had a bunch of stuff in my trunk. I got off work early, and I looked at the sky, and I'm like, it's a perfect bluebird day. I have 6 hours of daylight before the sun sets. I can hike into the cabin, drop off some supplies that I need for this restoration project I'm specifically working on, and then I can hike out. So because it was so spontaneous, I didn't do any of the things I normally do, which I would normally check the weather. Had everything in my car. I didn't even go home. I just hiked in. I didn't have any of my essentials. I didn't have an InReach. I didn't have a Canyon radio. Like, I had nothing. So I hiked in, dropped all this stuff off, and I was here about 10 minutes, and all of a sudden I just heard this howling, and I heard all of this acorns just, you know, stuff like falling on the roof of my cabin, and I was just like, oh, this is a really, really bad sound. And now this is within the first year after the fires. The fire, because it was slow moving, it was actually going underground and it was burning the roots of the trees. So while the trees were standing and they looked green, the roots themselves actually were not stable. I have to get out of here. So I immediately locked the cabin up and I'm hiking down. And I was about 7 minutes from the cabin. The wind is blowing from behind me and it is a howling wind where you could feel the push of the wind. You could feel the debris kicking up off the ground. And I was just like, oh God, I'm in a really bad situation right now. I gotta get out of here. All of a sudden, I'm in this grove and I can see these trees waving back and forth. And there had to have been 60, 70 alder trees. And they're just bending and going back and forth. And all of a sudden, I start hearing this sound that I had never heard before. But I knew exactly what it was when I heard it. I heard a tree stressing beyond the point of it being able to hold itself up. And I heard what sounded like an old creaky ship where the wood was being stressed. And I heard this tree snap, bend, and break. And I turned around to me, and the wind is blowing in my face at this point, and I watched a giant 100-plus-foot alder fall down and take out three other trees with it. And this is about 50 feet from me. Because I turned to look, because I'm hearing a sound that is terrifying me, I see this tree fall, takes down these other trees, and now debris is in my eyes. I'm literally like trying to get the debris out of my eyes. I can't move because I don't want to take a misstep. I can't see, but I still am like, oh God, I got to clear my eyes up. As my eyes are closed and I'm just trying to blink the debris out of my eyes, I hear what sounds like a giant animal running towards me. Eyes just in the nick of time to see this huge buck that was where those trees had fallen, and it was doing the same thing I was doing, just trying to get the heck out of there. I mean, this was just the most gorgeous animal I'd ever seen. Turned my back to sort of the wall of the canyon, because I'm like, oh my God, this thing's running straight at me. It's also in a panic mode. It sees me, and so then it dips down, and I'm watching it run across the creek. The wind is still blowing, and all of a sudden I hear that same sound of that stressed wood, and I hear much closer than this one tree that took out these other three trees, and I look, and there's an old oak. They're really rigid. They don't sway the way the alders do, and it cracks and breaks, and this tree was literally 15 feet from me, and it snaps and it breaks away from me. And I am just like, I gotta get out of here. That 50-minute hike was about a 25-minute hike. I just hauled it out of there. And I laugh now because I made every mistake in the book. I had no essentials with me. I had no InReach. I had no Canyon radio. Nobody knew where I was. So essentially, if one of those trees had fallen in the wrong direction, it would have fallen on me and no one would have known I was there. This story is actually a story I teach my students about preparedness, because in all of my years of being an outdoor educator, I didn't do any of the things I specifically remind people to do about preparedness, your 10 essentials, letting someone know what your trip plan is, so in case there is some unforeseen circumstance. It was just such a good reminder. It reminded me, like, Pamela, practice what you preach. And it was really quite a hair-raising experience.
I lived in Florida for 9 years previous to moving to LA.
my acting career kind of took off in Florida because at the time they had a tax credit. And so a lot of productions were happening there. They were shooting like 5 or 6 TV shows, a lot of film and stuff was going on. And so I was kind of building momentum with acting there. But I was getting older. I was getting into my late 30s. And then I was thinking, you know, maybe we should go to LA. Maybe there's more opportunity. I'll be getting more auditions. I won't have to drive 3 hours to Orlando. I call it the grand bargain because my wife originally didn't want to move to LA. But she said, okay, I'll tell you what, I want to travel for 4 months. So let's save up as much as we can and in the next 2 years. And if we travel for 4 months, I'll move to LA. So we traveled to India, Nepal, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore. Really, aside from Costa Rica and a few islands in the Caribbean, my first and her first extensive international traveling. And it was just such an intense experience. Baptism by fire. At the time, I didn't appreciate what I had. My whole mentality was, I gotta get to LA, I'm getting older, I'm running out of time type of thing. I had just shot this lead role in an action comedy feature and I thought it was gonna open some doors for me. My mentality when we're at the Taj Mahal, when we're trekking in the Himalayas, was just not a place of where it would be now, which would be a place of gratitude and in the present moment. It was more of a place like, this is nice, but let's go. In a lot of ways, I kind of ruined that experience for my wife. Because I was so negative and so, we gotta get to LA. And it was just such a stupid mentality looking back on it. After I got to LA, it wasn't what I had thought. I didn't realize that the industry was totally different. Movie stars that had been acting in the mid-budget movies were now doing TV, and so they were taking roles from like the up-and-coming actors, and so just the studios were collapsing and Netflix was taking over. And so that led to definitely a midlife crisis. I'd have an audition and I'd be like working on the lines and I would just be so angry and she would say, you know, this doesn't seem to be bringing you any joy. And she was right. It may have started from a place of love and passion, which I think for most people it does, but for me it had turned into kind of a burden. That is how I defined myself for so long that I didn't know how to define myself any other way. I knew a producer out here. She was a friend. She said, to compete in the market now, you have to have a YouTube channel. You have to be on social media. And I wasn't even on Facebook until 2014. So I was like so far from social media. It wasn't even on my radar, you know? I had not edited or shot anything since I was 13 on like 8mm tape. So I started editing some stuff from the trip that we took. Like, well, I had a ton of old footage from that, but my first vlog was like 2016 going to Death Valley. It was terrible. I was just throwing stuff against the wall and like I had this encounter at the gym with some like crazy internet boxing troll guy and then I end up telling the story on a shaky cell phone video. It's like my fifth video since I did the first vlog and that ended up like going viral. And like getting over 1 million views, and it was like a blessing and a curse. It wasn't something I wanted to be known for, you know? I just felt it was too negative. I had discovered like travel vlogging. That piqued my interest, but we didn't have any money to travel. So I was like, well, I'll just do like some hikes around LA. And then if you look at kind of the top videos that are performing in these same hikes that everyone does, and you're like, I'm never gonna be able to compete with this guy who's already got all these views and all these subscribers. So I'm like, I don't know what the point of this channel is. I don't know what I'm doing. I just was at a major crossroads. And then around 2017 in Zuma Canyon, near the fork where Newton Canyon comes into Zuma Canyon. And there's three waterfalls kind of in this immediate vicinity, Newton Canyon Falls, Lower Newton Canyon Falls, and Lower Zuma Falls. I decided to come for a hike and make a video. And it was right before sunset, and I ended up climbing down this Lower Newton Canyon Falls. had never really rock climbed before or done any canyoneering or anything, and I was just like, oh, I think I can climb down that waterfall. It was kind of low flow, real ledgy and juggy and more of a scramble than a climb. And I climbed down. I was like, you know, super pumped. I went further down the canyon. There's a bunch more cascades and stuff further down and just kept going. And then eventually I realized the sun just set. It's going to get dark really quickly. Luckily, I had a headlamp. I realized, oh, I got to climb back up that waterfall now to get back to the car in the dark. And it was just such a new, unique experience for me. I felt like such a badass by the time I got to the top. And I felt so alive and felt so energized that my life changed in a significant way in that moment. And I realized, like, this is the type of thing I want to do with my life. Whatever this is, this outdoor adventure, hiking, whatever it is, like, I want to spend my life doing this. And the acting, I'm not necessarily quitting or giving it up, but it's like, that doesn't define me anymore. I want this to define me. This feels real. Instead of going and playing a character and pretending to have an awesome life, yeah, I can do stuff like this and actually have an awesome life, you know? Instead of going and pretending to be like James Bond or Jason Bourne or whatever that is, I could actually go and do this and it's much more meaningful and real.
One night we were in bed and somebody knocked on our door at midnight. It ended up being the Montrose Search and Rescue. They were asking us if we knew a way to get across the river. Usually, search and rescue doesn't want help from civilians, but they came and asked us, and Mark started to describe a way around the first crossing, and I thought, it's dark.
They're not going to find any of those landmarks that I told them about.
So I just started putting on my clothes and boots and said, I'll show you. And we went down there together, showed them how to get across the first crossing. We just went ahead and crossed the second crossing, which was crotch deep and rushing. And then the third crossing
was also crotch deep and rushing. We knew the places to go, so they were really grateful.
We knew the widest spots and how to rejoin the trail so you don't just have to make it a bushwhack all the way. We ended up getting to the Boy Scouts a lot faster than I think they ever would have reached them, and then they rigged a zip line. And we stayed and guided the Boy Scouts back. Everything worked out. We got back at 3 in the morning, just went to bed.
It was actually really fun. Those Boy Scouts were really game.
It was the time of their lives.